WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the 60s, when teenage girls in America and England fantasized about romance with their favorite Beatle, Cynthia Lennon was married to John. They shared a working-class background and met in art school in 1957. They were married in 1962. During the years John toured the world, Cynthia was at home, raising their son Julian, who's now a rock star. Cynthia and John divorced in 1968 after John fell in love with Yoko Ono. John was assassinated 12 years later. In 1985, I spoke with Cynthia Lennon about what it was like to be a Beatle wife. She told me that she met John in her second year of college. They got married after she got pregnant. The Beatles were just getting started.
When did you realize that something very extraordinary was happening with that group?
Well, they were always extraordinary. Even as youngsters, as students, they were extraordinary. They had charisma about them. They had a great raw energy. And I think it was possibly when they were in Hamburg, when they first went to Hamburg, and they were out of the country, out of their hometown, and they were faced with an audience of ruffians and sailors, and they were working in the Reeper Barn in Hamburg. And they had to cope with different types of audiences, very hard, work very long hours. And that was when the magic started coming out, and that was their apprenticeship.
You were told by Brian Epstein after a while, the Beatles' manager, that you shouldn't be too visible as the wife. They didn't want the fans to know, I think, that that Lennon was married, or at least they didn't want to play it up. I mean, how were you told that? Did he tell you that directly?
Well, he didn't exactly tell me, but he did speak to John about it. And, of course, John explained to me the situation, because in those days, it wasn't done for a pop star to have a wife. It would take away from the group. And, of course, the beginning of the Beatles, Brian wanted a lot of adulation from the fans. He wanted a lot of support from the fans. And, of course, it wasn't done. If the lead, in fact, the main man in the group, who was John, was found to be married, then it might take away from that particular success. So I walked around pregnant for quite a long time, hiding it. You know, I'd wear very big blousy clothes. And in fact, I was asked many times if I was John's wife, and I had to refuse and say, no, no, I'm somebody else.
When fans did find out who you were, what kind of emotional reaction did they have toward you? Did a lot of the teenage girls really hate you or become jealous of you because you had the person who was the object of their fantasies?
Not at all. Do you know, I was very lucky, really. I think I expected it. I really was a little worried about it. But all I've ever had from the fans has been love and support. And if there was any envy or jealousy or hate, it didn't come across to me.
Did they want to live through you in a voyeuristic way?
In a way, yes. I think the fact that they wanted to wear the same makeup and wear their hair the same way and wear the same clothes, and that was flattering in a way, but it wasn't antagonistic at all.
It's funny, you know, you mentioned your hair, and you've mentioned that John Lennon wanted you to look like Brigitte Bardot, that he was really fixated on Brigitte Bardot.
Yes, he was. He had plenty of posters of Brigitte Bardot and Mylène de Montgeau and many, all foreign. And, of course, a Liverpool girl trying to emulate that sort of style was something else. I couldn't change my accent to French, but the one thing that I could do was to grow my hair. And, of course, I started lightening it, and it got lighter and lighter. And then he was very fascinated with black stockings and short skirts and, you know, and for me it was difficult at first because I was pretty conservative. They used to call me Miss Powell. You know, they used to think of me as a sort of secretary type with specs on, glasses on. And I always used to be kidded about it. And they'd always say, oh, here comes Miss Powell. And this was before John and I got together. And then, of course, when we did get together, I just, I didn't fall in, but I was influenced by him a lot. You know, of course, I mean, I loved him. So I did as much as I could to please him in that respect. And I pleased myself as well, because I was a little bit fed up with being called Miss Powell.
What was it like in the days when you were a young mother? And John was mostly on the road touring, and he'd have, I guess, like a couple of weeks here and there in between tours to come home and play the role of husband and father. Was he able to make that transition from rock star and figure of fantasy to young father and husband?
Extremely difficult for him, because even though when he wasn't on the road touring, he was in the recording studio. So we saw very little of him. And when he did come home, he was so exhausted and so tired and so overwhelmed by the pressures of the outside world that when he came home, all he wanted to do was to collapse. I mean, he used to sleep an awful lot. And he would wake up when we were ready to go to bed, if you know what I mean. With a small child, you have to be up early in the morning, and then you're pretty exhausted at night. Whereas John's hours changed. You know, he'd be up at night and in bed during the day. So the whole fabric of our life changed because of the work that he was doing and because of the pressures from outside.
Were you exposed to any of the groupies who were hanging around John Lennon and the other Beatles then?
Well, actually, the first experience, which was funny for all of us, when we first came to New York and we were staying at the Plaza, I think it was Murray the K was there. He was the first disc jockey that we'd ever met, American disc jockey, so I was very impressed, but he happened to be there. And in the room, there were sort of all these draped, beautiful ladies. This was their suite, Murray the K, and about five beautiful model ladies all draped round. And we all walked in and looked at them and looked at each other and wondered what on earth we were supposed to do in a situation like this, because it was obvious, you know, what they were there for. And, of course, I was the fly in the ointment because I was the wife of one of the Beatles. So it was embarrassing for them and embarrassing for me. And it was a situation that clicked with me. I mean, I realised then what it was going to be like, you know, in the future. I mean, obviously, that was what it was going to be like, just women throwing themselves at them the whole time.
Well, what would you do in a situation like that? Would you be the one to leave?
No, no. I mean, in a situation like that, no. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, if you're not there, there's not a lot you can do about it, is there? And, you know, men are very easily tempted when they're exhausted and tired and they need not necessarily sleep. You know, I'm not being crude on this, but I mean, it's one of those situations in that sort of life.
Did you ever have a desire to have other relationships too, since chances were that he was having other relationships?
Not at all. No, I'm a one-man woman. I always have been. And very difficult. You know, I suppose it sounds not boring, but, you know, in this day and age, there's so much infidelity and all sorts of things going on. But no, I'm a one-man woman. And I believed and loved my man at the time. And there was no way I would have dreamt doing anything like that.
One of the changes that he experienced, which I would assume you didn't, at least to that degree, was the introduction of marijuana and hallucinogenic drugs. I mean, the Beatles became famous for mm-hmm. that. Did you participate in any of that? Were you anxious to try it?
I was never anxious to try it. But our first experience was a friend of George's, actually, a dentist person, and we went for dinner, and after dinner he put sugar cubes in our coffee, which were laced with LSD, and of course it hit us all at the same time, and we had the most horrendous night and a very dangerous drive home. We could all have been killed because we were absolutely out of our minds, and for me that was hell, sheer hell, mental torture, and I couldn't cope with it. And I would never, ever have wanted to do it again. And yet for John, it was something else. You see, John was a different animal. He was a searcher. He desired something new in life, constantly changing, constantly wanting new experiences. And, of course, he didn't have a bad time on this particular drug. So he tried it again. And then if you realize at a time like that when there's so much money around, and so many hangers-on, there are bound to be pushers, and there were pushers. We were surrounded by pushers. So there was no denying that there was plenty of supplies. You know, they didn't have to do anything. They were captive audiences to these people who are constantly pushing the drugs.
Did that create a wedge between the two of you, since he was living in an altered state a lot of the time and you weren't?
Most definitely, because it's a division of two minds, really. I couldn't go along with it. I just couldn't. I hated the whole business. I could see what it was doing, not necessarily to John, but to a lot of people. Lost a lot of friends through drugs. And with John, it altered his personality for me. I mean, I just stayed the way I was, and I always have done as far as I can. I mean, I've developed and I've gone on. But John was going so fast, and I couldn't keep up with him. And I didn't want to keep up with him on that level.
What are some of the other ways you saw him changed by the fame and the money that he achieved?
I think he became extremely lethargic at home, really rather sad and tired. He just didn't have any stimulation anymore. He was losing out on concert tours. He wasn't happy in his performance because he couldn't hear himself. He wasn't getting any audience response. He wasn't close enough to the people that he was entertaining anymore. I mean, he was surrounded by adulation and material goods and all the things that other people would think were fantastic in life. But for John, it wasn't enough. It wasn't good enough. It wasn't honest enough.
So what did it look like he was going to turn to instead?
Well, I think it was very hard to describe what he was going to turn to. I mean, he was on that particular road. We did turn to meditation and the Maharishi in India.
Did you go to that?
Yes, I was there for 2 months. But he took that wholeheartedly again, and so did George, very, very deeply into meditation. And I didn't. I took half and half, sort of tried to get a balanced view of it. So I would do artwork. Half of my time was doing artwork and half of my time was doing meditation, because I didn't want to get hooked on anything. You know, I think you've got to believe in yourself and your capabilities. And I think John again was looking for an escape. But this time it was a healthy escape. It was escape into meditation, into peace of mind, relaxation, away from the pressures. And it was at this particular time that he met Yoko. And, of course, again, before we went to India, Brian died. So the whole thing, our whole lifestyle changed again very quickly, you know, after the first time. I was constantly changing. And this was a great break and a great rift for all of us. I mean, we're all devastated by Brian's death.
We'll get back to our 1985 interview with Cynthia Lennon after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1985 interview with Cynthia Lennon.
How did you first meet Yoko?
I met her, where was it? Actually, when I came home from a holiday. But I had seen her before. I mean, I met her physically, we could say. And she'd been staying with John the night, and I came home and they were there, which was sort of curtains for our marriage as far as all of us were concerned, really. But I had met her once before at a meditation meeting.
You knew right from the start when you saw them together that this was it, that this was different from just having an affair with someone?
Well, I keep saying it was feminine intuition. You know that something's going to happen, and only you know that something like that is going to happen because of your sensitivity and your knowledge of the person that you've been living with for 10 years already. You know exactly what's going to happen. And as far as Yoko was concerned, I knew there was not a thing I could do about it, any more than there was anything I could do about John taking drugs at the time. There was no way I could have stopped him.
He initiated divorce proceedings, right?
Yes.
And he accused you of adultery.
Well, you see, this is the madness of it all. I, to this day, don't understand that, but it's almost as though, I've tried to work it out, it's almost as though John's attitude in life was the best form of defense is attack. Now, he was guilty of letting me down in public. I was on holiday when the information about John and Yoko came out in the newspapers. I didn't know it was open to the world, the situation. And I was on holiday and somebody showed me a newspaper. And then an emissary of John's came over to visit me in Italy. and said, John wants a divorce and he wants Julian. And there's a detective. Now, I was on holiday with my mother, my aunt and uncle, and Julian. So God only knows why there was a detective put on me. You know, it was one of those situations that I will never understand.
You still angry about that?
No, I'm not. I'm really not angry. If I could understand it more, it would be easier. But I didn't get a chance to have an explanation for it. I'm not angry about it. I'm really not. It's just, it's in the past. It's finished. It's done.
Were you able to talk with him? Would he make time to talk with you about the divorce proceedings?
Not really. It was all done through lawyers and solicitors.
That must have been very frustrating.
It was very sad. Very sad that you were cut off so quickly. Cut out of somebody's life so quickly. But there's not a lot I can say about that.
I can't imagine what it was like for you, you know, to, after going from the, you know, fairly conservative childhood to suddenly being in the middle of all the Beatlemania stuff, and then it ends, you know, then there's a divorce and you're still kind of identified with it, but it's in a lot of ways out of your life. And you didn't have the money anymore either.
No. Well, I think it's called survival. It's simple as that. I think you have to survive and you have to keep your feet on the ground and hope for the best and keep on laughing, you know, in life. I'm not laughing now, but I mean, you must carry on. I had a son to look after. I had a child to bring up. And what if I'd fallen by the wayside, what would have happened to him? Very important. Julian was very important to me at that time.
When John and Yoko went off together, their relationship was probably the most press-covered relationship of the year. They were on the cover of everything. Mm-hmm. They were holding press conferences in their bed. I mean, it was one big media event after another. How much of that did you want to expose yourself to? Did you read it?
Oh, I read everything, yes. Because, of course, the man that we had divorced, it didn't mean to say I'd stopped loving him or caring for him or worrying about him. I mean, because I didn't have any anger or bitterness about it. I had a lot of hurt. But of course I was looking after his interests in my own little way and caring about his future and hoping that he was happy, because he'd had to go through such hell to do what he did. And he became almost a leper in the eyes of the British and the press. And he had hell to go through because he broke away from the system of being one of the four mop tops that were doing so well and such good ambassadors for Britain. And he moved out of that and he became an individual. And he did what he wanted, to the extreme, as John would always do anyway. And I felt extremely worried for him, really, at that time, because he had to take so much from the press and media and from fans and people who loved him.
How do you think his personality was changed by the relationship?
I think he found his space. I don't think he found the complete satisfaction in life, because I think he was always searching, always looking for it, always wanting something new, always. I mean, he was due to come back to England, you know, near the end, just before he died. So he was constantly changing and looking for new quests. But whatever he did, it was totally honest and wholehearted.
Cynthia Lennon recorded in 1985. Over the summer in London, she had an exhibition of her cartoons depicting her years with John Lennon. This is Fresh Air.